Sounds True presents Mantra, Sacred Words of Power, Session 5, The Avatar Mantras, Part 1.
Even though we know that our nature is essentially divine, we forget. We forget both individually and as a species. After all, we have things to do. We have our lives to live with its various tasks and responsibilities, whether it's jobs or raising children or running a government or running an organization. We have things to do, and these things occupy our mind. And over time, we tend to forget that we are essentially divine. And when this happens, most compassionately, we get divine help. The most notable has been what are called the avatars of Vishnu. The avatars of Vishnu are divine beings that come in human body and have helped us for thousands of years. And over this portion of the course, we'll talk about those avatars and some mantras that will help us solve a variety of problems that we face in everyday life, both spiritually and materially. Avatar means one who descends from above. This implies that they have no karma like the rest of us. The saying is, they come with clean hands. They come with no karma. They come with gifts to give. They come with divine authority and grace to help us get where they are. So if an avatar is one who descends from above, what kind of above are we talking about? There is a saying in Sanskrit. This is Narayana again, who says, Sambhavami yuge yuge. The meaning is, for the protection of the pious, to move along the evolution of the species, to protect it from evil, I myself will take embodiment and come and help humanity in various ways. And this is the spirit of the avatar, again in terms of Narayana, who bodies himself forth, this time not as Brahma, but as Vishnu, to come to serve, to preserve, to quicken the spirit and bail us out when we get in trouble. There are more than half a dozen different kinds of avatars that come. Really, we're only concerned with three of them. One is the Maha Avatar. And this is one who gives a completely new interpretation to the scriptures and whose message is universal. An example of this would be the Buddha, who came and reinterpreted some of the scriptures and brought an entirely new teaching. There are 10 major avatars of Vishnu. 9 of them have already come, and 1 is yet to come. And of the 9 that have come, the first 4 were not human. Now let's talk about that for a moment. The first is called the Fish Avatar. And it is written that in an ancient time there was a deluge, similar to the deluge of Noah, and the known civilization of the earth was threatened, and a giant fish came and saved humanity at that time. Then thousands of years later, there was the tortoise avatar, where an entire continent was in trouble, and the Kurma avatara saved the continent. There may be some tie-in here with the tectonic history of India, because if you look at some of the geological progression that are computerized and animated, you'll see that India moved up and slammed into the southern part of Asia, creating the Himalayan mountains. So that in a mythological sense, the tortoise avatar of Vishnu saved the subcontinent of India, where future avatars were going to be born and bring teachings. The third avatar was called the Boar Avatar, and this is said to be a being that dived deep to secure a place for land to be anchored as other continents shifted around the globe. We have no evidence to indicate exactly what this activity was, only that there was a divine boar that saved us when another crisis of a geologic nature threatened civilization. With the fourth avatar, Narasimha, we have the appearance of a being in at least a semi-human body. And here we have Narayana as a conscious entity, much more closely involved. And here is the setup. Narayana is in his realm. Brahma has sprung from his navel lotus. The universe has been created and is ongoing, and Narayana is watching it. And he creates two small guards called Jaya and Vijaya, his attendants. Now, the sages in creation know that Narayana has great power. So when a huge crisis threatens, they sit in meditation and make contact with their own divine self. And in their divine mind, they make contact with that realm where Narayana is, and they go to Narayana, and they seek to speak to him about the problem that is besetting Earth and her inhabitants. But Narayana is taking a nap. He has said to his assistants, Jaya and Vijaya, "I feel like I need to take a little snooze, so kindly guard me from being awakened by extraneous matters, and let me take a nap." So saying, he dozes off. Jaya and Vijaya stand guard. Now here come the sages, the Brahmarishis, and they say to Jaya and Vijaya, "We have to speak to Narayana. There is an urgent crisis that demands his attention." And Jaya and Vijaya say, "Well, I'm sorry, O learned gentleman. I cannot wake Narayana. He is sleeping now and has requested that we leave him undisturbed for a period of time." Sages say, don't you understand that this matter is much more important than some nap? You know, we have to awaken him immediately." "I'm sorry, we may not do that. If you do not, we will curse you where you stand." Now, these Brahma Rishis are so upset with the crisis and their inability to solve it that they stand ready to use their divine power to move these fellows aside. And Jaya and Vijaya stand firm and say, "We will obey what Narayana has asked." So the rishis say, "Well then, let it be on your head." And upraising a hand, they chant a Sanskrit mantra and depart. They had been gone only a short period of time when Narayana awakes and says, "Well, that was wonderful. Any news for me?" Whereupon Jaya and Vijaya say, "Well, there was a terrible crisis on Earth, and some Brahma Rishis came. They demanded to see you. We followed your command and would not allow them to wake you. But they were upset, and they uttered a curse. What shall we do?" Narayana says, "The nature of the curse was that you be separated from me. Now, I've created this universe, and it runs according to certain laws. And I can't change the laws of the universe, that wouldn't be right. But I can alter them. So I will alter the curse in this way. You can be born 100 lives on Earth of divine parents and have a wonderful life. Or you can be born 3 lives as demons and then return to me." Jaya and Vijaya, without hesitating, said, "Well, we'll take the 3 lives. We'll be born as demons, and that way we don't have to wait 100 lives to come back to you. We can back in just 3. Narayana said, "So be it," and smiled. Of course, Narayana knew all about the crisis on Earth. He knew that the Brahma Rishis would be unable to solve the crisis. And being the one from which this entire cosmos has sprung, he knew that they would eventually come to him seeking solution of the problem. So after dealing with the Rishi's curse and changing it to 3 incarnations on Earth, with a mere projection of his thought, he solved the problem that the divine Rishis had brought and set his plan now into motion. Jaya and Vijaya were now born on Earth in their first incarnations as demons, Hiranyakashipu and his younger brother. Now Hiranyakashipu, he was terrible. He defeated everyone. After he had defeated rishis, celestials, and sages, he took a wife and married. The celestials, in the meantime, were taken to the forests and disguised as hermits. Soon Hiranyakeshipu's wife became pregnant with a child. The child was born a boy, and they named it Prahalad. What they didn't know is that in the heart of the child, the mantra Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya was turning over and over and over again. So as the child grew, they naturally sent it to school. And as the young child studied, he was apparently learning the lessons that his father had wanted him to learn about how to conquer various people, what weapons to use, how to subjugate this group of people, and how to subjugate that group of people. So after several years in school, Hiranyakeshipu had Prahalad brought before him and said, "Well, now, what have you learned?" Now Hiranyakeshipu was a terrible demon, red eyes, full of anger, ready to brim out at any second. So when his child Prahalad was brought before him, he expected to hear the lessons of conquest. And so he said, "Dear son, recite that which is most important from all your studies leading to this time." Prahalad went to his father, bowed before him, and spoke. "I will recite to you now the most important thing I have learned thus far. I bow before the goal of all beings, the cause of all causes, Narayana, who is without beginning, middle, nor end. He who creates the world as Brahma, saves the world as Vishnu, and destroys and spiritualizes it again as Shiva. To him who neither waxes nor wanes, to that eternal one, I bow again and again." Now to say that Hiranyakeshipu was furious would be to understate the state of his rage. With red eyes and trembling demeanor, he spit forth, "Wretch! What unfit lesson is this, full of contempt for me, who have dominion over all? Know you not that I have the boon of Brahma himself?" And in fact he did, and here's how it happened. Vishnu had come secretly as a warrior and dispatched Hiranyakeshipu's brother, taken him from him. And Hiranyakeshipu, in anger at Vishnu, had decided he would take a discipline that would give him the most possible power so that he could ultimately defeat Vishnu himself. And he went into the forest and performed austere penance and spiritual disciplines. And it became so intense that a scorching flame emerged from the top of his head and began to scorch the known universe. The celestials at that time were concerned and went to Brahma to solve the problem of the scorch coming from Hiranyakeshipu. Of course, he knew all about it, and when they arrived, he said, "Hello, warm today, isn't it?" Well, they told him the problem, and he said, I'll take care of it. And he went to Hiranyakeshipu, and he said, "Your discipline is wonderful. Ask me a favor and I shall grant it." Without hesitating, Hiranyakeshipu gave thanks to Brahma, whom he called grandfather, and said, "O Lord, O grandfather, let me never be killed by the following means: the striking and throwing of weapons by my enemies, thunderbolts, dried tree trunks, high mountains, by water, by fire. Let me be freed from the threat of death, even from the celestials. But why go on?" And then, of course, he did go on. "Let me never be slain in the indoors, or in outdoors, or during the day, or at night, nor by man, nor by beast. Let this be." Brahma said, "I am pleased. You shall have this. For the next 96,000 years, your desires will be fully satisfied, and you shall have complete sovereignty." And with that, he departed. So this was the blessing of Brahma that he gave to Prahalad's father, Hiranyakeshipu. And when Hiranyakeshipu heard his son praising Narayana, instead of himself, who could not be defeated by any means, he was enraged. He sent him out to be instructed again. Prahalad returned with the same kinds of praise of Vishnu. Finally, being a demon, Hiranyakeshipu determined that his own son should be killed. He said, "Let this evil boy be killed. He's become a burning coal within his own family. There is no point into his living further." So he commanded the servants to kill him with their weapons. And as he did, young Prahlad spoke and said, "The Supreme One dwells in all weapons, in yourselves and in me. And because this is true, your weapons will not strike me." And as they tried to kill him, they could not. Well, it's a long story. They tried to kill him by half a dozen different means. By snake bite, through poison, by magic, through burning in a fire, by holding him underwater so he would drown. But each time Prahlad was perfectly safe. Finally, Hiranyakeshipu commanded the court magicians to combine their sorcery and dispatch the young Prahlad. When they did so, young Prahlad said, "Your works cannot harm me. The Supreme is in us all." And the magic returned to the magicians, and they themselves were reduced to ashes. Now Prahlad, being a divine soul, fell to his knees and poured forth from his heart, "Narayana, Narayana, save them, O Infinite One. If it be true that you pervade the world and protect, if you are the indweller and all-pervader, and since I think of my enemies even while concentrating on you, because there is no separation among us all, then let them live. I bear no ill will towards those who have tried to burn me, poison me, trample me, or spear me." And at these words and by Prahlad's touch, the magicians rose and with joined palms addressed him with respect. "Dear child, may you live a long and unobstructed life. May you be full of strength and vigor, and may you attain all the four ends of human life." And they left. The prayers of young Prahlad did not stop there. He prayed that his father be converted to loving him, even though his father had tried to kill him. And by the power of Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, his father underwent a change, and even though he was still a demon, he was now kindly disposed towards his son. But the karma that he had created, his evil deeds of subduing the world as a demon, had to be balanced. And in another realm, the great balancing for those sins began with the creation of the mantra, Om Kshraum Narasimhaya Namaha. Om Kshraum Narasimhaya Namaha. And a being came into existence that had the combined body of a man and a lion. And this was the fourth avatar of Vishnu, called Narasimha. Narasimha. Long talons, long snout, fierce sharp teeth. Narasimha appeared in the town square where Hiranyakeshipu was celebrating his dominion over the realms of the earth. He killed some of the attendants of Hiranyakeshipu and then disappeared. Hiranyakeshipu returned home, and there he saw this being waiting for him, this fellow hairy in the extreme with long talons, with mane and fangs. He was not concerned. He had the blessings of Brahma, and he could not be defeated. However, speaking directly to him, the man-lion proclaimed, "You will not escape from this encounter. Even though you have repented and now greet your son warmly, your many sins must be balanced. My appearance and your death at my hands will clean the slate for your next incarnation. Three such incarnations, and you will return to the bosom of him whom you serve and adore, but have forgotten." Hiranyakeshipu said, "I see the head of a lion, but the brain of a bat. I cannot be defeated. Let's do it." And so they began a huge battle. But Narasimha, tiring of the exchange, picked him up and strode to the entrance of the castle of Hiranyakeshipu and said, "Your boon from Brahma is that you may not be killed, neither inside nor outside. Observe, we are on the threshold of your castle. We are neither inside nor outside. The sun was just setting at that time, and he said, Observe how now it is twilight. It is neither the day nor the night. Your boon is you could not be killed neither inside nor outside, neither the day nor the night. But it is neither of these things. Finally, your boon was that you could not be killed by man nor beast. You can see, I am neither of these things, but a combination of both. And so saying, he killed demon Hiranyakeshipu on the spot, and Prahlad assumed the kingdom where he ruled with compassion for the rest of his life. So this is one of the demonic incarnations of Jaya and Vijaya from that great being Narayana, who came and bodied himself forth as Narasimha, the avatar that defeats the seemingly indestructible. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. Well, that's a grand story, but how does it apply to our daily life? I have a friend named Kay. And about a year ago, she was besieged by some terrible neighbors on one side of her house. Constant loud parties till 3 a.m, cars coming and going all time of the day and night, loud music blasting seemingly 24 hours a day. She got no peace at all. So she called me and said, What can I do to relieve myself of this condition? I've tried asking them. I've knocked on their door. I have spoken with them in the most kindly way that I can, all to no avail. What can I do? So I gave her a Narasimha mantra. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. Now Kay took to this mantra, just as one knows when one is eating good food. And she began to do it as she was vacuuming the house, as she was getting ready for bed, sometimes even drifting off to sleep, the mantra would be turning in her again and again. But she also dedicated one period of time every day where she would sit quietly and with her mala, with her rosary, she would chant it using her prayer beads. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha, Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. And after 2 months of this activity, her noisy neighbors sold their house, moved away, and the people who bought the house were quiet and friendly. So this is a mantra that you may use when other means don't seem to work. Try Kshaum Narasimhaya Namaha and solve the problem, invoking the energy of Narayana in the form of the man-lion god who defeats the seemingly indestructible. Now, among the words in the mantra, Kshraum may sound a bit unwieldy. It's K-S-H-R-A-U-M, Kshraum. Now, Kshraum is a new seed sound. It's one we have not discussed before. And Kshraum is the seed sound for making visible that which was hidden and for bringing into power that which was in potential, but not kinetic. So it is the seed sound of Narasimha. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. Narasimha is the entity. Namaha means I salute. So the rough meaning of the mantra is, I take that energy which destroys the seemingly indestructible, and I make it manifest, and I salute it. Om Shraum Narasimhaya Namaha. There's another mantra contained in this story. Remember the 12-syllabled mantra? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Now, to be sure, this is a liberation mantra. It will take one to mukti, but it has worldly applications as well. Some spiritual teachers give this mantra to couples who wish to have a divine child. I know of one such instance, and in fact spent several years living with this couple who had received such a mantra. It was a community that we lived in, a religious community of various religious persuasions. There were Hindus and Buddhists and Jews and Christians. We all lived together in perfect peace and perfect harmony. And this couple received a mantra because they wanted a divine child. And they were faithful and practiced it. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And after a due course of time, why, the woman became pregnant and had a young son, Michael. Now, at this time, I'm teaching at the university, and I happen to run into famed anthropologist Colin Turnbull, who spent his time going around the world and living in various cultures, and then writing about them as anthropologists do. And as we met in the check cashing line and struck up a conversation, he informed me that the Mbuti hunt every day, this is a group of pygmies that live in Africa, by going to the youngest among them, who are still more in touch with their divine nature, and asking all of the children of the village under five to determine for the day in which direction they should hunt. Now, I thought this is interesting, because this exactly corresponds to the Vedic idea that when we are young, when we are babies, even before the age of five, we are more in contact with past lives and with our own divine nature. So fresh from my conversation with Colin Turnbull, I thought I would test these ideas in my own life. I would test the idea that a baby is in contact with its previous lives and its own divine nature. And I could do it with young baby Michael living in the very house where I dwelled. So that night as I came in the back door, the opportunity immediately presented itself. Here was young Michael sitting on the counter while his parents were preparing his food. And he was leaning back in his car seat and facing me as I entered the back door. I joined my palms in front of me and bowed forward from the waist and gave him the greeting of Namaste, salutations to the divinity within. Immediately, his eyes grew large, and there was joy on his face, and he stretched forth his tiny little hand and joined his thumb and forefinger, and then his three fingers came together, and he extended his arm in the gesture of wisdom, Jnana Mudra, perfectly performed by this tiny, tiny baby. I can tell you, the look on his face was not the look of an infant, but the look of a fully conscious being, and the hair on my body stood on end, and I had goosebumps in waves all over me. Immediately I began to speak to his parents, who were busily occupied, but you know how such things often are. They were flattered that I said nice things about their son, and when I tried to say, here, look, the moment was over. They had given the baby a bottle of formula, and he was busy sucking away and not interested in me or in anything else except that formula. But it was enough. I knew from my small experiment that it is true. These babies do remember their previous incarnation, and I concluded that in this case, the mantra that had been given them worked very well, for that ancient Jnana Mudra could only be given by one who is spiritually advanced and spiritually developed. So if you want to bring a divine child into your life, I can most highly recommend the mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This great mantra has a variety of uses. The primary use, of course, is in making your identification with that great being of which we are all a part. In the name of the indweller, the Vasudeva aspect of Narayana. Bhagavate means in an embodiment. So essentially what you are saying when you say that mantra is, in my body, I want to have complete identification with that which has created this entire cosmos. And to that idea, I salute. Now, because that mantra takes you to that realm, It is also a wonderful mantra to use if you want to send spiritual energy to those who have passed on. You can sit with a picture in front of you or with the picture of the person who's passed on in your mind's eye. And in their behalf, you may chant this mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You'll be helping them greatly. And you'll also be assisting the elimination of karma that you may have existing between you and that other person. Because all karma is unfinished business. And if by helping them, you can help conclude the business you have with that soul, you will be helping them and helping yourself to move on with your journey through many lives. The fifth avatar of Vishnu is called Vamana, the priestly dwarf. Again, we have a situation where the earth was in trouble. There was a king who had taken things under his control, and he had learned some of the secrets of magical powers and had used it to kind of control things on the earth. And Vamana, the priestly dwarf, after much drama, solved a problem for the king, and the king said, fine, ask for something you want, I'll be glad to give it to you. And so Vamana said, well, I just want a place I can retire to. I'd like as much land as I can cover by three of my strides. The king thought that was amusing because he's a dwarf. And he said, certainly. He didn't realize that this dwarf was none other than an embodied form of Narayana as an avatar of Vishnu. So his first step covered the entire earth. His second step, all of the heavens. And the third, he put on Bali's head and said, I would like this as the third place. So in three strides, he had covered not only the heaven and the earth, but the very person of the evil king Bali. And with that, he was dispatched, and Dharma, righteousness, was once again restored on the earth. There's a saying in the East, the world is a dog's tail. And what they mean by that is that you can straighten it out, but as soon as you let go, it curls back up again, as most dogs' tails are curled. So several thousand years pass where things are relatively under control. And then once again, we have a succession of evil kings who have taken up fiefdoms around the earth. And the sixth avatar of Vishnu is sent, Parashurama. Now, Parashurama has a job of destroying the evil kings one by one. So he's shown with an axe, and he travels over the earth, and one by one he conquers the armies and chops off the heads of the kings. And he is also teaching as he goes about the four tyrannies. And those tyrannies are rulership by kings or government that goes uncontrolled and oppresses the people. Rulership by merchants or the business class that goes uncontrolled and begins to take over the interests of the people. Rulership by the working class that goes uncontrolled and takes over the government to the detriment of the people. And fourth, rulership by the priests of the religion class that goes uncontrolled and begins to subvert the needs of the people. So as he's teaching these things and as he's chopping off heads, Parashurama finally arrives at the point where there is only one more king whose head must be chopped off. And the name of that king is Ravana with his brother Kumbharnaka. Now, interestingly, these two demons are the next incarnation of Jaya and Vijaya. Remember in the story of Narasimha, we had demon Hiranyakeshipu and his younger brother. Well, here's their second incarnation, later, as Ravana and Kumbharnaka. So as Parashurama is on his way to defeat Ravana, he hears that there is a contest going on to string a bow that allegedly came from the great Lord of Consciousness, Shiva. And this interests him. So he stops his journey on the way to Ravana's kingdom and decides to go see what this contest is all about. As it turns out, the contest of stringing this bow is really for the hand of the princess Sita in marriage. And so we join Parashurama on his way as he comes up to the crowd. Unbeknownst to Parashurama, the next incarnation of an avatar has taken place. And this is unique among the 10 avatars of Vishnu, because usually they're separated by hundreds and more likely by thousands of years. But in this case, they are actually on the earth at the same time. Rama is going to take over the work of Parashurama and then do his own work. But Parashurama does not know that. In addition, Rama is interesting from a number of standpoints. Let's take a moment and talk about Rama and how Rama came to the earth. There was a king of India who had several wives and consorts. All of them wanted children. He wasn't quite sure how to go about selecting one that would bear his heir. And a celestial being appeared and said, "I can solve the problem." And he had a ball of divine substance. Took the ball of divine substance and broke it in two. One half he gave to a woman called Kausalya, and she swallowed it and became pregnant. The other half he broke in two and gave one of those halves to one woman and the other half to another woman. She, in her turn, shares it with her sister and takes her portion and splits it in half. So we have, in effect, four beings from this one ball of divine substance. All the women become pregnant, and from that issue are born Rama, his brother Lakshmana, and twins Bharata and Shatrughna. Now they share a consciousness, and we have a unique situation where one consciousness of an avatar in the form of that ball has been shared among four people. But they all know who they are, and they all know what their jobs are. So the children are born, and they grow up, and Rama is the heir apparent. Through court intrigue, he is moved out of his place of natural succession to the throne, and Bharata, one of his younger brothers of the twins, is appointed the regent to succeed him. Further through this same court intrigue, Rama is banished to the forest for 12 years. Now, Bharata knows perfectly well that Rama should be the king, and so he does a very clever thing. As Rama is about to leave, he says, "May I have, please, a pair of your sandals?" And Rama says, "Sure." And he gives Bharata his sandals. Bharata takes the sandals and places them on the throne where he was supposed to sit and says, "Rama is the true ruler of this kingdom. Even though he may have been banished, still he is the ruler. I will be his regent, and I will manage the government. But Rama's sandals shall always remain upon the throne as a symbol of Rama being the ruler of this kingdom." So as Bharata places the sandals of Rama on the throne, Rama, his brother Lakshmana, and Rama's wife Sita go into the forest, where they will be banished for 12 years and kill some demons. And in the divine drama, this is really an opportunity for Rama to bless many people who are now living an agrarian kind of life. But before we continue the story, we have to tell you a bit about how Sita came to be Rama's wife. Rama hears, as a youth, that there is a beautiful princess who lives in a kingdom not far, and is the daughter of a king named Janaka. And this princess is the ideal in every way, and there are many suitors that want her. So Janaka devises a contest whereby he will take a bow that was reputedly given by the emblem of consciousness, Lord Shiva himself, a bow that is so strong that only the greatest could string it. And he places it upon a flat rock and says, "Whosoever is able to string this bow shall have my daughter Sita as his bride." Rama hears about this. So he and Lakshmana go off to observe and participate in the contest. When they arrive, many people have tried to string the bow. Most, holding it on one end, are not able to even move the thread an inch. So powerful is the bow. After everyone has tried, Rama says, "Well, Lakshmana, it must be my turn." And he strides to the rock upon which the bow has been placed. Quickly taking it down, he bends it to put the string on, and bends it so quickly and so forcibly that the bow cracks in two, with a reverberating sound that thunders off into the distance.
Mantra, Sacred Words of Power, Session 6, The Avatar Mantras, Part 2.
Now you remember that Purusharama, who had been on his way to slay the last demon king, had heard about this contest, and out of interest, had decided to go observe it. And he was nearly upon the scene when he heard the loud crack. And intuitively, in a place of agony inside, he had a thought of what it might be. Hurrying his pace, he arrived at the scene and saw the bow split in two, useless on the ground. He also saw a young, handsome man and a smaller man standing beside him, and he bristled as he approached the two men. "Who has cracked Shiva's bow?" he demanded. Lakshmana, being full of mischief even while divine, says, "Old man, what do you care? You would not be able to marry such a beautiful princess anyway, so it is of no consequence to you. Keep silent." Purusharama, completely unused to being addressed in this way, trembling with his finger on the handle of his axe, says, "Young man, be careful how you speak, lest those words be your last." Whereupon Rama moves forward with joined palms, addresses Purusharama, and says, "O ancient and most honored one, please excuse my younger brother. He has an arrogant tongue and does not know how to leash it properly." Well, Purusharama was calmed at these words, but Lakshmana could not be contained and said, "I do not fear you. So what if you try to kill me? You're so old and decrepit that if you lift your axe, the weight of it itself might cut off your own head. Then I would have the reputation of having killed one such as you. I could not stand such awful fame." That was it. Purusharama could brook no more. And he lifted his axe and began the rotation of his shoulders that would bring it surely and swiftly down. But again, Rama intervened and said, "O most kind and generous Purusharama, please excuse my younger brother. When parted from you, he speaks nothing but words of praise. Yet, as I said, he is bridled with such an insulting tongue that he cannot help himself. Kindly have mercy upon him." Trembling, Purusharama lowers his axe and says, "You speak well, young sir. By your words I shall spare his life. Who are you?" Whereupon Rama joins his palms again and says, "I am your replacement, Purusharama. I am the next avatar who has come." Purusharama replies, "I have been told that when my replacement comes, only he will be able to pluck an arrow and shoot it from the bow of Vishnu, which I have sitting upon my shoulder. If what you say be true, I will now give you that bow, and let us see if you can let flight an arrow from it." Purusharama started to reach for the bow, but it leapt off of his shoulder and into the hands of Rama. Whereupon Rama took an arrow from his quiver and shot it off into the distance with speed, strength, and great ease. At that moment, a ball of light came out of the chest of Purusharama and entered into the chest of Rama, and the transfer of power and authority was complete. Instantly Purusharama knew what had happened. He realized that Rama had spoken the truth, that Rama was his divine replacement. And with great relief he joined his palms and said, "Now that my replacement has come, I may leave off my task of separating heads from their bodies and may go quietly into the forest and meditate for the rest of my days. Salutations and goodbye." And with that, He went into the forest and made good his promise, and sat quietly in meditation, experiencing great joy, and reuniting his consciousness with the divine, Narayana. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So now the seventh avatar of Vishnu has been fully invested with the power. He and Sita become married according to the ceremonial standards that are accorded such a one, a king and a princess. Then all of the court intrigue that I spoke about earlier took place, and Rama, Sita, and Lakshmana are banished to the forest. So now we rejoin Sita, Rama, and Lakshmana as they journey into the forest. And because the avatar of Vishnu is wandering through the forest, all of nature responds to the divine authority of Rama and the divine purity of Sita. And as it is written in the epics that record the life of Sita and Rama, the Ramayana, by the great poets Valmiki and Tulasidas, all of nature responded. The birds began to sing more beautiful songs. The trees began to produce more luscious fruit than ever. And the taste of the water became sweeter, even though it was the same water. As they wandered through the forest, they came closer to the place that Parashurama had been off to, the kingdom of Ravana. Now, gossip travels very fast, and Ravana had heard that Rama and his family had been banished from the kingdom into the forest, and so he set out of curiosity, to spy upon them. When he finally catches up with them, hiding behind a tree, Rama and Lakshmana become distracted by a deer, and they decide to go in search of the deer and leave Sita resting under a tree. This is the only opportunity that Ravana needs. He kidnaps Sita and immediately takes flight to his kingdom in the south. When Rama and Lakshmana return, they look everywhere and realize that Sita is nowhere to be found. Now Sita is the very divine energy of Rama. Remember how we talked about that consciousness is masculine and the power of consciousness is feminine. Brahma had his Saraswati. The fire has its power to burn. And Rama has Sita, the divine energy itself. So Sita, as the divine energy of Rama, is destined to be with Rama. Any separation can only be temporary, because in fact, they are one being. You cannot separate fire and its power to burn, and you really cannot separate Rama from his power, Sita. While they are searching for Sita, they come across a group of monkeys, and one they befriend who seems to be a bit of an outcast from his own group of monkeys. He immediately falls at the feet of Lord Rama and proclaims himself your foremost servant, because he recognizes the divinity in Rama. Rama in turn recognizes him and invests in him the power of his foremost servant, and said, your first task is to go in search of Sita and find out where she has been taken. So saying, the monkey called Hanuman, the foremost servant of Rama, takes flight, speedily going through the trees as if he were flying, and finds the place where Sita is held captive by Ravana. Meanwhile, Rama and Lakshmana are journeying through the forest, carrying out the other purpose for their banishment, and that is meeting various saints and sages and celestials who have taken up abode here, and blessing them so that they may achieve the goal of liberation. At one point, Rama spies a rock laying flat upon the ground, and he purposely goes up to it and trods upon it, and immediately it springs into a woman who bows at his feet. And she says, oh, thank you, Lord Rama. 1,000 years ago, I was cursed to take the form of this rock, and I was told that an avatar of Vishnu would trod upon me and bring me back to life. And now here you are. Thank you and salutations again and again. He immediately blessed her with devotion and liberation, and he went on his way. Now, as we said earlier, gossip moves very quickly, and the news of Rama's turning a rock into a woman spreads everywhere. In due course the next day, Rama comes to a river which must be crossed, and the only way to cross it is with a ferry boat run by a boatman by the name of Guha. Now, as Rama and Lakshmana approach, Guha is in a quandary. He's heard the story of the rock, and so he's thinking in his mind, how can he approach the impending situation? So Rama and Lakshmana approach. Rama says, "Kind sir, would you please take us across this river?" And Guha says, "I know who you are, Lord Rama. I have heard that the dust of your feet can transform a rock into a woman. I have this boat as my only means of subsistence. What if your feet should turn this boat into something else? Then I will have no means of subsistence for my family." Now Rama was very much pleased at this devotion of Guha, and he understood that Guha not only knew who he was, but the great power emanating from the chakras in the feet. All of the great masters and avatars have huge chakras in their feet that pour forth an enormous charge of spiritual energy. This accounts for the tradition that you will see in the East, where students will bow down and touch the feet of their teachers. Because even today, some teachers have those chakras in the feet open, and there is great spiritual energy that pours forth from those feet. So Rama knows that Guha is aware of the chakras in his feet. Rama inquires, "O boatman, with such divine perception, what is your name?" The boatman replies, "My name is Guha, O Rama, and I would request to wash your lotus feet so that the dust from them that has transformed a rock into a woman will not transform my boat into something else. If I wash your feet, surely you may enter my boat safely." Rama, very much pleased at the devotion of Guha, allows his feet to be washed, and the tremendous spiritual energy pouring forth bathes Guha in divine light and divine energy. Rama and Lakshmana then get in Guha's boat, and he takes them safely across to the other side. Whereupon Rama says, "Guha, you have taken me across this river. Now what are your charges?" And Guha responds, "By your grace, I have taken you across this river. You kindly take me across this ocean of rebirth, so that I no longer have to be born, so that I have mukti, liberation, from being reborn again and again." Rama, very much pleased at the devotion of Guha, says, "I will liberate you here and now, on the spot. I am so pleased that I ask you, request some favor, some boon, anything at all you want, and I will grant it." Guha says, "Having mukti and liberation from you, I have everything." "Nonetheless," says Rama, "ask for something." And after thinking a moment, and Guha says, "Here is my request. I request from you that the name of Rama itself be superior to all other vibrations in removing that karma which may bind us to the earth plane, so that by saying your name itself, Rama, 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 we reduce our karma every time we say it and move closer to liberation or mukti." "So be it," said Rama, and went on his journey. And from that day forward, any mantra that has the name of Rama in it is very powerful in moving us towards liberation. In fact, there is a mantra that is known as the Taraka mantra. Taraka means that which takes one across. And that mantra is, Om Shri Rama Jai Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. Om Shri Rama Jai Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. Om Shri Rama Jai Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. Om, we know. Shri is a word which means the feminine power of Sita, Shri. Rama, you know, the name of the seventh avatar of Vishnu, Om Shri Rama, Jaya Rama. Jaya means victory. So the mantra means, oh, divine Rama with your power, victory, victory again to Rama. Om Shri Rama, Jaya Rama, Jaya Jaya Rama. It means victory to the divine self in each and every one of us. Victory in overcoming our karma. Victory in being liberated so that we no longer must be reborn on planet Earth and can move on to our next set of lessons as an evolving soul in the next place, whatever that may be. Om Shri Rama Jaya Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. Now, while Rama and Lakshmana go on their journey of Sita, I will tell you that in modern time, this mantra was practiced by the great Indian Mahatma Gandhi. Now, Mahatma Gandhi, when he was a young child, was initiated into this mantra, as it were, by his nurse. His nurse would sit with him and chant this mantra again and again, and it agreed with young Gandhi, so that all of his life he chanted, Om Shri Rama Jaya Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. Om Shri Rama Jaya Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. And it's interesting to note that although this is a mantra to bring liberation, Gandhi used it to achieve transformation of worldly affairs on a grand scale. He liberated India from the rule of the British, and all the while, turning around in his heart, was the beloved mantra of Rama, Om Shri Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. And even at the moment of his death, there is a spiritual law called the Law of the Last Thought, which says, the last thought at the time of death will strongly influence where you are born in your next life and under what conditions. So all of his life, Gandhi knew that he was preparing for the moment of death when he would chant the name of Rama. And so we even have recorded on film, because we have that moment captured on film, that at the moment of his death, he is chanting, Hey Ram, Hey Ram, even as life is passing from him. So great is the power of this mantra, then, that I would encourage you, if you have worldly or governmental affairs that you were involved in, or if you want to use it for administrative affairs or business affairs to make things operate properly, correctly, and with a noble spirit, the mantra has great power for transforming all of these activities. Om Shri Rama Jaya Rama Jaya Jaya Rama. So you see that this mantra for liberation can be used with great effect in solving problems related to the world, as well as problems in eliminating the necessity for rebirth. Because of the blessing given to Guha, the name of Rama has great power in eliminating our karma. In spiritual physiology, it is said that there are a masculine and a feminine current in the body, and that Ra goes down the right side and Ma goes down the left side. And that by clearing these currents, these channels of karmic debris, we can evolve very quickly. And so the simple mantra to reduce the debris in these channels is the name of Rama. Rama, 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 Rama. Hey, Rama, 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 Rama. Shri Rama, 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 Rama. Hey, Rama, 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 Rama. That mantra is very powerful in balancing the masculine and feminine currents within, clearing them of karmic debris, and speeding our evolution. There's another story connected with the name of Rama. It will change even the most negative nature, and even if you pronounce it incorrectly, let me demonstrate by this story. There was a murderer. He was a robber who used to hide in the forest, catch people unawares, take their possessions, and kill them. And one day, there was a sage who was devoted to Rama, who was traveling through the forest. And this murderer tried to waylay the sage. But the sage said, "Why are you trying to do this to me?" Sage caught him. But the sage stopped him with an upraised hand and the power emanating therefrom, and said, "Why are you attempting to do this? Why do you wish to rob me and then take off my head?" And the murderer said, "This is the only thing I know how to do. This is the only way I can take care of myself." And the sage said, "I can help you. I have a mantra that will bring peace to your mind and give you new ways to earn your living. And that mantra is Rama, 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 Rama." So great was the avatar Rama who walked among us that his name has power. Interested, the murderer tried to say the name of Rama, but his tongue was so evil he could not even form the syllables. So finally the sage, being a clever fellow himself, said, "Then say it backwards. Say Mara, Mara, Mara." And so the murderer and thief said, "Let me try. Mara, 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 Mara." And as you can hear, after time, it became Rama, 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 He, Rama, 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 Rama. And he immediately went into meditation, and a huge anthill came to grow around him from the activities of ants in the nearby area. And years later, the sage returned, and he saw this huge anthill, and he said, "Where is my disciple that I gave the mantra Rama?" And from inside the anthill, he heard, And so the sage took his trident and carved open a small opening, and the man emerged with a new name, Valmiki, which means one who has emerged from an anthill. And Valmiki went on to write the great epic saga Ramayana, the story of the life of the seventh avatar of Vishnu, Sri Rama. So you can see that the power of this mantra is so strong that it can turn the karma of a murderer and a robber into the karma of a saint. One word, Rama, Rama, Rama. After leaving Guha, Rama and Lakshmana continued their journey through the forest. Meanwhile, Hanuman, traveling at light speed through the trees, has arrived at the castle of Ravana the demon, and he has found where Sita is hiding. Now, he doesn't have enough power to defeat Ravana and free Sita, but he can return and tell Rama where Sita is hidden, and with all speed he does so. They adopt a straight-line flight for Ravana's castle, and a huge battle ensues, and Hanuman is fighting all the attendants of Ravana, and Rama and Ravana are fighting. Finally, at the end, Rama is about to cut off Ravana's head, when Ravana, his demoniac nature clouding his wisdom, the veils part for 1 second, and he sees Rama for who he is. And he says, "O Rama, even though I am born in a demon body, still, I am your devotee. Om Shri Rama, Sharanam Mama. Om Shri Rama, Sharanam Mama. Om Shri Rama, Sharanam Mama. Om Shri Rama, Sharanam Mama." Which means, "In Rama, I take my refuge." Whereupon, Rama blesses him with return to the abode of Narayana, from whence he had been outcast, and immediately cuts off his head. Thus ends the second incarnation in demonic form by Jaya and Vijaya from long ago, when they were cursed by those sages and altered by Narayana. They will take their third and final incarnation when the avatar Krishna arrives. But with the concluding of the story of Rama, we are left with a fertile field of mantras that are efficacious in solving worldly and spiritual problems. Those mantras are Om Shri Rama Jaya Rama Jaya Jaya Rama, and its short form Rama, 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 Rama. And the final mantra, Om Shri Rama Sharanam Mama, which means, I take shelter in the name of Rama. Sometimes we are in life situations where we're not quite sure how to proceed. We know we need help of some sort. We're not quite sure what that help should be or how things should work out, in spite of our sincerity. And this mantra, Om Shri Rama Sharanam Mama, is efficacious for invoking that kind of divine help which may be non-specific, but which we need. And that's why we say we take refuge, and Rama, send us the help we need. Om Shri Rama Sharanam Mama. Om Shri Rama Sharanam Mama. Send the help, even though I may not know in what form it is best for me. Om Shri Rama Sharanam Mama. Finally, there are two mantras that pertain to Hanuman that energize the prana. These can be used for those, for instance, who are engaged in athletic competitions. As the prana grows stronger, the muscles will grow stronger and the limbs more flexible, and we're able to call upon more energy. These mantras are Om Hum Hanumate Vijayam. Om Hum Hanumate Vijayam. Om Hum Hanumate Vijayam. Om, you know, the seed sound for the brow center. We've talked about it several times. Hum, you'll recall, the seed sound for the throat center. Hanuman, the energy of the prana. And Vijayam, which means victory. We encountered Jaya, Jaya, and Vijayam is another form of that word, which means victory. So the meaning of the mantra is victory to the prana on its evolutionary course within the body. Victory to the prana. Om Hum Hanumate Vijayam. The word hum in this mantra is efficacious in removing blocks near the throat. The two places in the spiritual physiology that we all have where energy tends to become blocked is near the base of the spine, near the genital center, and near the throat center. And this particular mantra helps open the throat center and blockages related to that. The other mantra will help with blockages which may exist at the base of the spine because it brings the prana to that place by saying Shri Hanumate. Those two words together help relieve blockages that may occur at the genital center. The full mantra is Om Shri Hanumate Namaha. Om Shri Hanumate Namaha. Which at the surface level means salutations to the conscious prana, which has been infused with the divine feminine energy. Om Shri Hanumate Namaha. So with the drama of Rama and his incarnation with Sita, Lakshmana, and Bharata, the second of the incarnations of Jaya and Vijaya in their demonic forms comes to a close. The next one will happen as we take up the eighth avatar of Vishnu, Krishna, where they are born as the demon Kamsa and his brother. And after this incarnation, Jaya and Vijaya may return once again to the abode of Narayana, the curse having been concluded. Of all the avatars, Krishna is reputed to be the most full incarnation of divine power from Narayana. Ironically, I'm going to spend the least time talking about Krishna. Here are the three things that he did in his incarnation, which was a huge drama just like the life of Rama. Number one, there were 16,000 sages that were very close to liberation. And the power of Krishna's incarnation was such that he had the authority to liberate these very high beings. The second thing that Krishna provides for us is a slender volume of teachings called the Bhagavad Gita. It is a series of lessons on the different ways to achieve liberation. And the Bhagavad Gita has become one of the most widely read spiritual scriptures in the world. And the third thing he has done is leave us with a series of mantras that will do one of two things. Bring us to a union with divine love and reduce our karma. First, mantras to bring us into ecstatic union with the idea, the principle of divine love. Om Shri Krishnaya Namaha. Om Shri Krishnaya Namaha. Om Shri Krishnaya Namaha. You'll remember Om is the seed sound of the brow center. Shri represents the feminine power. Krishna is the being and Namaha is I salute. So you are asking to become embraced by divine love in the form of Krishna. The other mantra that will produce that effect uses the seed sound kleem that we discussed earlier. Remember the seed sound of attraction? Kleem. So the mantra is Om Kleem Krishnaya Namaha. Om Kleem Krishnaya Namaha. Om Kleem Krishnaya Namaha. That says, I am attracting to myself the principle of divine love in the form of Krishna. There is one final mantra associated with Krishna that we should discuss, and that is a mantra called the Maha Mantra, because it very powerfully reduces negative effects in this age of winter, spiritual darkness. Many of you have heard the mantra, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Rama Ram, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. The meaning of the mantra primarily uses the names of the avatars of Rama and Krishna. It also has a word Hare in there, which means I hail or salutations. So essentially you're saying, hail to Rama, hail to Krishna, hail to Rama, hail to Krishna, over and over and over again. There are organizations that chant this mantra hours and hours and hours. And they prefer to sing the mantra rather than say it, and so I shall also sing it. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And you can sing that over and over and over again for a long time. And I can tell you from experience, if you do it for a while, it will make you feel wonderful. Of all the avatars of Vishnu, the ninth, the Buddha, is by far the most controversial. And to understand why, it's useful to look at the socio-political religious conditions of the time. First of all, the Brahmin priests were selling indulgences similar to what the Catholics did in the Middle Ages. If you wanted to buy a ceremony to make it rain in your neighbor's crops, there was a price for that. If you wanted your neighbor's cows to become your cows, there was a price for that. And they were withholding mantras from the people so that the people would have to pay them to perform the ceremonies. And they scared people so that they would continue to use the priests. If you don't use us, terrible things would happen. Another aspect of the time was that some of the mantras that weren't being given to the people were leaking out to non-religious people on the outside who were using them for strictly material and worldly means. So that on the one hand, the mantras are being withheld from the people. On the other hand, they're being given to, say, the merchant class, who is using them strictly as a powerful way to increase their business. With this tableau, we have the Buddha, who appeared around 563 BC and started teaching as close as we can determine sometime around 540. Born a Hindu, the Buddha's personal name was Siddhartha. And his family name was Gautama. So he was known as the Hindu Siddhartha Gautama. And he was born into a very wealthy family that shielded and protected him from the outside world, so that he had no understanding of such things as sickness and old age. Well, one day he slipped out, and he encountered these things. He saw people begging on the streets. He saw people dying of hunger and various diseases, and he saw old people, which he'd never seen before. And he was so overcome that he left the palace, renounced his life, and went out to find the higher truths. Eventually he became the Tathagata, which means one who has the truth. Buddha means the enlightened one, and Buddha is really a state of consciousness and not a title. And Gautama Siddhartha is generally recognized as the Buddha. Now, he tried several things. There were various paths of austerities from the Hindu tradition that he attempted, and they didn't work for him. He tried fasting, he tried bodily postures. He tried these routes, and they were unsuccessful. And finally, he sat under a tree, the Bodhi tree, and he sat there for 43 days. Not unlike Christ in the wilderness, he was tempted. And he was tempted by a female figure called Mara. She offered him all manner of magical goods and a worldly title, and he turned them all down and eventually became the enlightened one, the Tathagata. Now, once he had achieved a state of enlightenment, he returned to the world, and he realized that the state of religion was, frankly, a terrible mess. So when he began to teach, he went after the abuses of the priest class in the following way. He said, "Let's not talk about the soul. We'll only speak about where you are right now. And for most of you, that's not a very good place. You're suffering in some way." And then, taking the doctrine of karma that was common to Hinduism, he said, "Because we know that karma results from actions in a previous life leading to rebirth in this life, we have to take ultimate responsibility for where we are. We have a history of depending upon Rama and Krishna and the great ones, and that's fine. But sooner or later, since they all teach that we are divine, sooner or later we have to take responsibility for that divinity, and we have to take responsibility for where we are right now." So he started with the four noble truths. First, existence as we know it is suffering. Second, our misery is rooted in ignorant craving, desire for things that really won't help us out spiritually. Third, that this misery can be abolished by eliminating ignorant craving. And to do this, you follow something called the Eightfold Path. As he began to teach enlightened self-interest through right living, the effect upon the Brahmin priest class was dramatic. It reduced in numbers, and many of the mantras stopped leaking to the outside world. So that 100 years later, the science of mantra had lost most of its appeal for the non-religious, the secrets had stopped leaking to the outside, and those who wanted power sought it through politics and government rather than through mantra. So from this standpoint, the job of the Buddha was masterfully completed. He brought a divine psychology based upon taking responsibility for where we are, and he reduced the problems with the priest class by thinning their numbers as more and more people became converted to Buddhism. One of the great mantras of Buddhism is that which prepares the mind to receive enlightenment. It's the Gate mantra, and I'll chant it for you right now. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. Often it's said in one breath and then said again like this. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. The meaning is gone, gone beyond, even beyond. Hail the goer. Bodhicitta means the spiritual mind stuff. And bodhi is that state where enlightenment of the mind stuff can be received. So the object is to achieve a state of bodhicitta. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. There are many more mantras for Buddhism, but most of them exist in Tibetan Buddhism, and we'll talk about that in a separate session a bit later. The 10th avatar of Vishnu is yet to come. In Hinduism, he's called Kalki, the coming one. It's interesting that at least 3 of the world's religions, probably more, have a myth about the one who comes. In Buddhism, it is the Maitreya, the one who is coming. In Judaism, They're waiting for the Messiah. In Christianity, they're waiting for the Messiah to come again. And in Hinduism, they're waiting for the 10th avatar, Kalki, the coming one. It is said that Kalki will come on a horse with a sword, and that sword will destroy the evil once again on earth and harvest the souls waiting for liberation that will then move into the next age of spiritual summer again, when 90% of the inhabitants of the planet are enlightened. There is no single mantra associated with Kalki, so we'll just have to wait and see how he manifests and what he teaches. So far we've discussed the 10 avatars of Vishnu, but we should understand that any teacher that comes and teaches us something about spirituality or how to solve worldly as well as material problems in a spiritual way contains the energy of Vishnu. Because that principle comes in all the spiritual teachers, in all the religions and all the paths. You know, we come with so many different cultures and climes and state of mind that the truth has to come in many different forms so that we can grasp it in the diversity of our way. But wherever roots to solving spiritual and material problems are taught on a path of nobility leading to liberation, there you will find the principle of Vishnu, the great saving principle of the universe.